explorers, welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. And welcome, Earth Explorers. This is Brooks Agnew. The solar wind tonight is a light 394.6 kilometers per second at the moment. The huge sunspot that was to come around and face Earth last week has evaporated along with its six smaller sisters, so the sun is blank today. Asteroid 2004 DC flew by Earth yesterday, about 2.5 million miles away. Friday, astronomers using the giant Arecibo radar in Puerto Rico pinged the asteroid and discovered that it is actually two asteroids, a 60-meter rock orbiting a 300-meter rock. Researchers estimate that one in six near-Earth asteroids are binaries. This adds further evidence to the claim by my co-author and I that the Earth is a binary planet. And one of the most remarkable finds in the last few weeks, you've probably been reading a little bit about it in the news, is the Bosnian Pyramid. Recently, there's an article that says the pyramid has all the elements, four perfectly shaped slopes pointing toward the cardinal points, a flat top, and an entrance complex. Quoting Dr. Osmanagic, we have already dug out stone blocks, which I believe are covering the pyramid. He is a Bosnian-American archaeologist who spent 15 years studying the pyramids of Latin America. He says, we found a paved entrance plateau and discovered underground tunnels. While working in the tunnel, we recently discovered huge sandstone monoliths with some symbols engraved on one of them. Just to give you an idea of what's going on in the world of modern archaeology. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can now make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web by going to x2-radio.com. We also want to welcome Global Star Radio Network and its satellite feed for X Squared Radio. This gives us an AM radio presence all across North and South America, live Sundays from 5 to 8 Eastern, or if they decide to run a delayed broadcast. And we appreciate the support of our producers at BBS Radio Network. And remember, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio. If you want to request that X Squared Radio be added to your local AM station live on Sunday evenings, please write us and tell us the call letters of your local affiliate, and we'll see what we can do. One of the first things people notice about X Squared Radio is our format. We run our content for about 50 straight minutes at a time, allowing our guests to fully make their point without commercial interruptions. They also notice that our archives are free for the listening. That is by design. My intention is to grow this program into the highest quality scientific talk radio program on Earth by giving you access to the best guests, the best technology, and the most open discussion of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth free of any charge to the listener. I want to accomplish that by asking our affiliates and sponsors to pay the bills and not you, the listener. If this is acceptable to you, then please, when you are ready to shop for cool stuff for your space, do it through X Squared Radio and we'll continue to grow. Next week on X Squared Radio, we have Michael Horn coming on the program. Tom Horn. In addition to his new book, Armin's Gate, we are going to discuss the arrival and presence of alien races on the Earth throughout history, and yes, even today. He is a world-class guest, so you don't want to miss that program. Also, don't forget to visit our online store. Tonight, we have a special edition of X Squared Radio. As you may already know, the Extraterrestrial Civilizations and World Peace Conference is being held in Hawaii next weekend. Dr. Michael Sala and his four guest speakers are going to visit with us and talk about their areas of expertise. We strongly advise you to get to this conference and partake of the knowledge as they have assembled for you. But in case you aren't in the neighborhood, you can get an idea of what will take place and visit their various websites and help them continue their work. Dr. Michael E. Sala is the conference convener and also president and founder of the Exopolitics Institute. He is author of Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence, that's Dandelion Books, copyright 2004, and founder of the popular website exopolitics.org. In his presentation, he will discuss evidence of how different extraterrestrial races are actively contributing to the promotion of world peace. With respect to off-world involvement in world affairs, I can think of no more important topic than this. So please welcome with me Dr. Michael Sala. How are you?
Aloha. I'm glad to be on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. I've actually never spoken to anyone on the island of Hawaii, so please don't tell me what the weather's like.
Okay, I won't tell you about the blue skies and the perfect weather then. All right.
Well, if you'll forgive me, I have this is quite a program we've put together. We've got five guests that we're going to bring on in every 30 minutes tonight. Dr. Sala is going to stay on with me and help me moderate and ask questions and help me understand the answers, maybe. Rather than accept phone calls, we are going to contact these speakers at the World Peace Conference. And we'll start, of course, with Dr. Sala, and then he'll help me with the other guests. If that's okay with you, the listener, then we will proceed. However, I will leave the email active during the program. So if you have questions, write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and we'll try to answer your questions. Now, when you write us, please give us your first name and from where you are exploring the Earth when you write. Okay, possibly, at least to me, the most important mystery of the universe is the question of extraterrestrial life. Well, one need only look as far as the Bible itself to be exposed to the idea of life existing in places other than this planet. I mean, God is clearly not from this planet. Adam was indeed built from the dust of the earth, but his DNA clearly does not come from this world. Eve, possibly the greatest achievement of genetic engineering on the earth, was engineered from the DNA in Adam's rib. But the female who carried the infant to term, birthed her, and raised her as a child was obviously not from this world. The fact that she was brought to Adam a fully grown woman has escaped nearly every reading of Genesis. The progenitors of the human race upon this earth were extraterrestrials. So why is the religious world so ready to stone those who claim that other civilizations have visited us and visit us as we speak? Well, I guess we can assume that since these visitors know how to get here from somewhere in space or time, that they are more advanced than we. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that they might have something of value to share with us. So, Dr. Sala, what kind of technology has your research shown is most valuable to our government?
Well, the technology that most interests the government is the ability that extraterrestrials have to travel large distances through the various solar systems to reach the Earth. And I think that's the technology that the government are very interested in. Firstly, they want to understand the propulsion system, how it is that extraterrestrials visit us from distant star systems, galaxies, and even other dimensions. They also want to know about the navigation systems. How do the extraterrestrials circumnavigate such enormous distances? And thirdly, they want to understand the communication systems used by extraterrestrials. How do they communicate amongst themselves, you know, between their home world and even with the citizens of Earth? So these are the things that the government is very interested in, and they have, by all accounts, gone to enormous cost and efforts to try to get as much information and as much technology concerning those capacities over the last 50, 60 years that evidence has started to emerge concerning extraterrestrials visiting the Earth.
So our government is trading with off-worlders?
I think that's the conclusion you can draw after you've looked at some of the evidence that's emerged about meetings that have occurred, especially in the 1950s. There were a variety of whistleblowers, witnesses coming forward talking about secret meetings and also arrangements existing with extraterrestrials whereby the government, and here we're talking about the secret government, not the kind of representational government that we elect into office, but we're talking about a secretly appointed group of officials that have the authority to communicate, negotiate, and reach agreements with extraterrestrials, and that that secret government, as we can call it, is really what's responsible for agreements that have been reached where technology has been traded in exchange for certain rights extraterrestrials have.
So you're saying the American government has a policy or a treaty in place that addresses trade behavior with off-worlders?
I would argue that's exactly the case. I mean, if we look at a number of whistleblowers who have come forward, they talk about various aspects of those agreements. For example, there was the whistleblower Dan Sherman, who wrote the book Above Black, who worked with the NSA, and he says that he was trained to communicate with extraterrestrials and pass on that information to the officials within the NSA. And he soon discovered that the information he was passing on was concerning the locations and the details of people being abducted within North America. And so what that was indicating was that an agreement had been reached whereby extraterrestrials would communicate this information in exchange for certain rights that Mr. Sherman wasn't aware of, but he certainly was aware that the abductions were occurring without the free will of American citizens. There are other cases as well which discuss aspects of these agreements, and Charles Hall, who worked at Nellis Air Force Base in the 1960s, is another example, and I can talk about him if you'd like.
Well, I guess it's safe to say then that the government is making agreements I guess by what you're saying, that we are interested in propulsion technology and communication technology that obviously people that come from other worlds or other dimensions, they have higher technology than we are, at least have on display, and they're trading people to them? Are the people willing to go, or are they going against their will and the government is just making this deal?
Well, we know from the data that the abduction phenomena happens without the free will of the people that go up. And we have had some whistleblowers say that not everyone that is taken up is returned, or certainly people who are returned often have a lot of traumatic experiences that they have to overcome with therapy and other mechanisms to try to kind of deal with the invasive procedures of these extraterrestrials. And it seems that this has been happening with the collusion of the government. I mean, it appears that isn't always a smooth process. It appears that whatever agreements have been reached have been violated by one or more of the parties. So it's not just a straight set of agreements that everyone is happy with. It appears that there have been violations. So perhaps the government may have given permission for a limited number of abductions, but that limited number becomes more with more excessive forms of force or procedures being used against abducted civilians.
I was wondering myself what Earth could possibly have that would be interesting to a race that could obviously travel to whatever place they wanted to in the galaxy or possibly in the universe. And, of course, I could see what they have that we want. Besides the propulsion technology, I imagine such energy sources could be used as weapons, which is always interesting to governments. Is there any weapons that have been learned from off-worlders, and what is the nature of the weaponry, and has it ever been used on Earth?
Well, there is some weapon systems that apparently have been developed as a result of collusion with extraterrestrials, and in particular, there's an example that Charles Hall has brought forward. He argues that the extraterrestrials that he witnessed while he was working at Nellis Air Force Base had the ability to manipulate certain elements within the body using a pencil beam weapon system. And what's interesting about that is that there has been patents that have been issued, and this is discussed in the book by Nick Begich, book Angels Don't Play This Harp, where he talks about patents that have been developed whereby various elements in the body can be activated by a certain weapon technology whereby it becomes deadly. So, for example, if each person in the body has a certain percentage of a metal or of an element, for example, iodine, this can be magnified to a level where it becomes deadly or toxic. And so this seems to be a weapon, a non-lethal weapon, apparently, that has been developed through collusion with extraterrestrials.
Well, I'm a little bit familiar with HARP. I was one of the contributing scientists to a documentary that Nick Begich participated in 1997, and he's quoted me a few times in his book, and he even writes the foreword for my second volume, so I know Nick pretty well. And I also know that that this kind of sonic weaponry, ELF weaponry and RF weaponry, has been used in the battlefield, and it's also been used in the public realm. I know every single cruise ship in the world is fitted with sonic weapons. And they're designed, of course, to run terrorists off, and I think made the news late last year when such sonic weapons did run off some terrorists that were trying to board a cruise ship. Well, one of the things that I find fascinating about this is the possibility of energy. Obviously, we have to mount our spacecraft with huge amounts of fuel just to get them off of our little blue planet. And then when we do get into space, we just don't have enough, we can't carry enough fuel to go very far. We have to rely on momentum and slingshotting to go very far, and it takes us months to get just to Mars. So I would think that the energy systems that these off-worlders could bring to us might be very valuable to our planet. Then maybe we could learn how to utilize our planet without oxidizing fossil fuels. So why have we not been shown these new technologies?
Well, that's a really critical question here. These technologies do exist because we know that this is how extraterrestrials visit our planet. And it appears that they have been subject to agreements, traders, some of these technologies for reciprocal rights or things that are of interest to the extraterrestrials. And it appears that this technology and the know-how has been used within the secret government, within the covert world of black operations that have been set up to try to replicate, back engineer extraterrestrial technologies, and that this has not been shared with the general public. So while we have had some advances, for example, we've got the laser weapons or laser technology, which is used in computers and hi-fi equipment. We've got, of course, the microchips, the silicon chip that's used for computers and tech and communications. We've had a number of breakthroughs, and Philip Corso, I think, is someone that does raise this question of just how many of our conventional technologies that we now take for granted have been passed on to us or have been kind of set up because of extraterrestrial technologies that have been passed on. But it appears that that has not happened when it comes to energy. We are still using the same energy principles that were used by the Wright brothers back in the early 20th century, that we basically need to have some kind of propulsion system which is based on expelling gases or exerting force upon the atmosphere to propel a ship or an aircraft forward. And this is really very old technology that's been around for 100 years or more. And whatever technology has been learned from the extraterrestrials hasn't been passed on, and that's a big problem.
I wonder why this kind of technology has not been passed on to us.
Well, I think there's probably a pretty major security threat here. For example, if we had technologies passed on where all of a sudden everyone on the planet could have something similar to a helicopter. I mean, of course, it wouldn't be propelled by rotary blades, but it would be propelled by some kind of free energy system. So imagine if everyone on the planet, or certainly those in the developed world, because maybe this technology wouldn't be uniformly spread to begin with, you know, had the means to be able to travel from, say, one part of the world, say, the Midwest of the U.S. to another part, say in Australia, within 1.5 hours. Well, you could imagine the security dilemma that it would create. And imagine if people could travel to nearby planets using these types of technologies. I mean, it would, again, create an enormous security threat. And I think that's one aspect. But probably the one that is really critical here is that the people who first were responsible for reaching agreements with these extraterrestrial races in terms of the technologies and how these would be disseminated. Many of these people were associated with the oil industry. And so, for example, the Rockefellers were very prominent with Standard Oil, and they were critical in the Eisenhower administration reaching certain understandings with extraterrestrials. And of course, the Rockefellers saw the oil industry as a way of maintaining a control over the population of the profits that energy gives to certain elites and to the black government, to the black covert projects. And so this is something that I think is a factor in why these technologies haven't been released.
So you think the very forces that are in charge of our high gas prices right now are the same people that are in charge of the technology that would render that same energy source obsolete? Or are you saying that the government controls it and the macroeconomic forces like the oil companies control government?
Well, I mean, there's a relationship between the government, and here we're talking about the secret government, not talking about elected government, because elected officials simply aren't briefed on this information. They are set out of the loop entirely. And at the conference, Paul Hallier will actually be speaking. He was the former defense minister for Canada, and he wasn't in the loop. And he's now, I guess, furious, really, that he was kept out of the loop, even though he was a senior official. So this is done solely by the dictates of an appointed group of officials who make these decisions, who are very closely related to oil companies, pharmaceutical industries, other industries that are reliant on using these old technologies, and that bring about certain sums of money, huge sums of money that are used or siphoned off for black projects, because they need to get this money somewhere, because elected political officials are not briefed. So it means that all the money that is raised in Congress goes out to various sectors of the federal government to do things that they can more or less track. So it means if you're going to have a vast infrastructure of black projects, reverse engineering and building fleets of, say, anti-gravity aircraft or space vehicles, you need to raise the money from various sources that can't be tracked. And I think the oil industry is one of those sources that can't be tracked.
Mm. Well, it certainly makes one wonder about tens of billions of dollars in new profits for oil companies, and it doesn't seem to be going out in new wages or new jobs, so it's got to be going out somewhere. And if you accumulate enough of this money, pretty soon you're talking about serious dollars, close to $1 trillion, and that's enough to fund a small country. You just wonder where all that money goes to. We don't see any new refineries being built. Frankly, I would like to see some other source of energy, cleaner and maybe more renewable and more accessible to people. One of the things that at least I see in my lifetime is energy and access to energy being used to control governments, worlds, people. If you can keep a people away from energy, you can keep them from being a world influence. Well, I did have one question that maybe we can answer in just a couple of minutes about the human abductions. I know at least one of your guests specializes in this phenomenon. But if we're talking about trading for weapon systems, for energy systems, for communication, for propulsion, the only thing that we have on this planet to trade is human and animal genetics, or is there something of more interest on our planet than that to them?
Well, I mean, we do have a population of well over 6 billion with tremendous biological diversity, and I think this is something that we have to look at seriously as being of great interest to some of the extraterrestrial visitors. I mean, the abduction programs regularly discuss the evidence basically points to genetic material being extracted and being studied and being manipulated by the visitors. And so they have great interest in our biological diversity, and it seems that this is part of some projects that the extraterrestrials have, and we're talking about some of the extraterrestrial visitors, not all, of course. They have projects that are designed to somehow extract and utilize our biological resources for maybe their own replenishment. Maybe we become a means of being able to rejuvenate a degraded genetic structure of some of the visitors who physically appear to be very weak.
Yeah, fragile.
And I think this is one of the questions that we can look at as to just how valuable we are as a very hardy biological species that has survived for thousands of years and has mixed with a tremendous diversity of other humans.
Well, with relation to world peace, I guess there are off-world races that think our government is good and off-world races that think our government is bad. Do you think, well, I guess I was going to ask, do you think there are benevolent off-world races and malevolent off-world races?
Yes, I think there's a lot of evidence that we have both here. We have evidence that there are many benevolent races who are genuinely trying to help individuals and groups develop their consciousness, learn about the extraterrestrial existence, and to be able to be more responsible in how we use our environment. But there does seem to be another group of extraterrestrials, and you know, whether we call them malevolent or whether we call them enigmatic, I mean, that's really a question here, because in many ways they behave in the same way that scientists treat, say, laboratory animals. And we don't consider scientists evil, but we consider them to be kind of amoral, and so I think some extraterrestrials fall into that category, and they're not very respectful of the rights of individuals, and so we would consider that to be very invasive and abusive.
Well, I hope there's no eternal debt to pay for killing lab mice, because I have certainly processed my share. I hope that that we're not judged on that. Well, what I would like to do is I would like to add Robert Salas to the line, if I can do that, but I will have to take a break with my producer, and if you will play my second break music, which is about 48 seconds long, I can give him the rest of this information without telling the entire world if he's there. If he is taking a break, then we'll just keep talking. I'm going to play a little background music.
All right.
Right on. Be about 4.5 minutes here.
Okay. How would you like me to address you, Dr. Agnew? Or?
Yes, Dr. Agnew with X Squared Radio.
Very good. Thank you.
Relax for about 4 minutes. We'll be right back. Some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the 6-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X-Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Brooks Agnew here, author of The Ark of Millions of Years. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service, so you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have neat gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. With us tonight, our special guest, Michael Sala, who is the convener of the Extraterrestrial Civilizations and World Peace Conference. And one of his keynote speakers, Robert Salas, is with us tonight. How are you, Robert?
Very good, thank you.
Hello, Dr. Sala. I think he's still on the line over there in Hawaii enjoying himself.
Okay.
If not, then our producer will try to get him back on the line. You are retired from the United States Air Force.
Well, I'm separated from the United States Air Force. I resigned in 1971, so I'm not officially retired from the Air Force, although I am retired from the federal government.
Okay.
I worked for Federal Aviation Administration for about 24 years.
All right. Well, the subject of your address at the conference is probably, what, the most documented encounter with a UFO in military history? Can you give us a brief description of your report? You don't have to give the whole thing, because we only have about half an hour.
Sure. Yeah, in 1967, I was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. This is Minuteman 1 missiles. I controlled Well, the crew I was on, of course, the crews control 10 nuclear missiles, and one early morning in 1967, it was March of 67, we had two phone calls, actually, from our guards upstairs. We were 60 feet underground in a hardened capsule, and of course, we're locked in down there. We can't get out for 24 hours. So first call, a guard saying they're looking at some strange lights in the sky and making some strange maneuvers. And basically, I didn't pay much attention to that. And then second call a little later, the guard is screaming into the phone saying he's looking straight out his window and just above the perimeter fence of our complex there called Launch Control Center or Launch Control Facility. He's observing a glowing red object that's hovering outside the front gate. He's very excited. He's got all the guards out there and their weapons are drawn. And then he has to go for one of the guards who got injured. He hangs up. I go over there and wake up my commander, who's taking a rest break, and tell him about the phone calls, and all of a sudden our missiles go down. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10. We lost 8 to 10. My commander recalls 8, and I recall all 10. But,
well, what does that mean, go down?
Well, go down meaning they couldn't be launched. They went into what we call a no-go condition. So they were in an unlaunchable mode, and this never happens. I was on duty for as a missile launch officer for 3 years in Montana, and we never had any incident even similar to this. Every now and then we'd have one missile go down and get into a problem, a technical problem go down, but not all 10.
Does that mean that the UFO, you think, was responsible for somehow nullifying the controls of all those missiles?
Well, it's hard to avoid that conclusion, yes. We also, after we contacted the command post, they informed us that the same thing had happened at another flight, and we're not sure whether it happened the same morning, but it did happen, and they lost all 10. And again, UFOs were reported over their facility, and not only the control facility, but the launch facility where the missiles are actually located. So we're talking about 20 missiles going down while UFOs are being reported by very professional guards at these facilities.
I served one tour in the Air Force, and I was stationed at Grand Forks Air Force Base. So we had, obviously, to do duty, go out on the missile silos and chip ice off the rails so the doors could open. But that would be something that would definitely make it through the rumor mill all across the base when that happened. How was the publicity of this event handled in those days?
By the way, your guess
well,
is...
We were told the incident was classified secret and not to talk about it to anyone. As a matter of fact, we weren't even able to talk about it among ourselves or any of the principals involved, the guards or other missile officers. So it basically Air Force shut us down. They told us don't talk about it. It's classified, and essentially I didn't talk about it until 1994, I believe it was. I was in a bookstore in Seattle, Washington, and opened up the book of Timothy Good, called The Above Top Secret. And in that book, he talks about the launch of 10 missiles during the UFO sighting at Echo Flight in Montana. And I thought, oh, well, maybe they declassified this incident. So, and I thought that was where I was. When I read that, I thought I was at Echo. The way the facilities are labeled is Alpha Bravo, Charlie, Delta Echo, you know, and on and on.
Does he quote his source in the book?
What's that?
Does he quote his source in the book?
You know, at this point, I don't recall, but later on I did find out that Ray Fowler, who you may know, has written other books on UFOs. But Ray Fowler was working for Sylvania, I believe, at the time, in 1967. And he had talked to one of the crews that told him about the shutdown. And Ray actually went public and gave an interview to the Christian Science Monitor, I believe. And they published the story. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that that is where Timothy Good got his information. But you'll have to ask Mr. Good that.
Well, doesn't this mean that the UFO had prior knowledge that the launch was going to take place? How do you think that happened?
There was no launch. These missiles are on ready alert.
Oh, I see. So there was no planned exercise or anything. They just showed up and took the missiles offline.
That's right.
Wow.
Right.
Wow. So they had some kind of ability to hack into that system, and they wanted it known that at will, I guess, they could just stop our offensive systems.
I think that's exactly the point. They there were two things. One, they wanted to say, hello, we're here. And point number two is we can shut down your most sophisticated nuclear weapon systems. And they demonstrated that. That's pretty significant. I think there was another message here, and this ties in with the peace conference that we'll be speaking at next week. And that is that we as a civilization, as people, have to get rid of our nuclear weapons, or we need to get rid of our nuclear weapons. And this is worldwide. I'm not talking about just the U.S., but worldwide. We need to re-energize that effort for total disarmament.
I couldn't agree with you more. Did you hear my producer in the background there?
No, that's Michael Sala. I just wanted to first say hello to Captain Sala and then just throw in a comment there about the significance of the nuclear weapons and the conference, because one of the things that has been, I think, successfully suppressed is the relationship between the visitors.
Yeah,
and
he's there. He's just
weapons.
Very quiet.
I just can't hear him.
Yeah, I don't know if our producer can jack his volume just a little bit or not. Are you there, Michael?
Try it now.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's a lot better.
Right, okay. I just wanted to add that from the very beginning of the UFO phenomenon, that there has been a relationship between the sightings of UFOs and nuclear weapons and nuclear facilities. And I think Captain Salas's experience is a very important one, because it does signify that there is a relationship here that we need to understand, and we need to really study this deeply to find out exactly what it is that concerns the visitors about nuclear weapons.
Yes, is there any evidence of communication on that basis, or do you think that they're just making examples, coming in and saying, look, you think your weapon systems are so sophisticated and you think that you can start a global thermonuclear war at will, well, we can stop that. But has there been any communication relative to that by off-worlders to people, say, other than government people?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I mean, you've kept quiet on this all these years. You've had this in the back of your mind. You walk into a bookstore and bam, here's the story on the front page, and you were there. So you've got, you know, a lot of interest in this subject, and I'm sure in the last, since 1999, you've had a lot of communication about it.
Yes, well, I'm doing my best to try to, tell this story, and as Dr. Sala said, made a very valid point, and that is that there have been many, many other instances where UFOs have been sighted around nuclear facilities. Just off the top of my head, you can name Bentwaters, Aviano Air Force Base in Italy, Minot, North Dakota, Ellsworth Air Force Base, many UFO sightings in and around nuclear facilities. And so, to me, that's very loud and clear communication from E.T. He's saying they pay very close attention to these nuclear weapons, and let's get rid of them.
Well, I guess we can discern from this activity that not all races, not all extraterrestrial races, are working with our government, but can and do interfere with at least some of the military intentions of our government. Wouldn't you say that?
I have no way of knowing how closely they're working with our government or not working with our government, but I think they're certainly making an appeal to the public at large, and this is another reason that our government ought to cooperate and disclose what they know about these things, because we're all in this together. It's not just government making decisions. This affects the entire civilization of the planet, and we all need to get involved in the conversation.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but I can tell you, sitting in numerous Air Force Now meetings and listening to briefings, that the military leadership, at least when I was in, which was in the mid-70s, they would consider the activities of these UFOs, at least in some part, a clear and present danger to the security of the United States. I don't think that they'd be, you know, really willing to cooperate with such activity.
Well, you're right. As a matter of fact, in 1969, well, let me take that back. In 1969, the U.S. Air Force issued a statement that no UFO incident has ever affected national security. Well, I beg to differ with them. The incident I just mentioned did affect national security. We had 20 missiles, nuclear missiles, go down during the Cold War and during the Vietnam War. There was a national security event, and the Air Force has not admitted to that. So, which tells me that they're covering this thing up. So,
Do you think the personnel of the military have received any orders to treat UFOs as hostile?
I hesitate to say because I don't know my own knowledge.
So you don't know if we've actually shot down UFOs in modern times?
I do not, no.
I think it's also worth pointing out here that there have been reports that nuclear tipped missiles have been actually deactivated while in flight. That one of the witnesses at the same airbase as Captain Salas, and that is Colonel Ross Dedrickson, he claims that some nuclear-armed missiles were actually destroyed by the extraterrestrials who were concerned about these, and even one on the way to the moon, he claims, was destroyed. So it does seem that there have been a number of incidents where the UFOs, the ETs, have actually behaved in a way that would be interpreted as a national security threat, but of course that hasn't been relayed onto the public.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, how is that reported? I mean, you got all these people, and a lot of them are civilians, watching this missile head out into space, and all of a sudden it just disappears off the radar screen? Wow.
Well, I think Captain Salas actually can describe something that happened to in the case of the Malmstrom deactivation, that the Strategic Air Command launched an inquiry, and then at some point the inquiry just kind of came to a halt and nothing more was asked. That he was briefed, and I mean, he can better describe what exactly happened.
I'm sorry, I had a hard time hearing you, Dr. Salas.
Well, I was just saying that you actually were briefed about some of the Air Force investigation that was concerning the deactivation, and maybe you could just explain how that investigation came to a halt and nothing else was ever released.
Yes, of course. The Air Force did conduct an investigation, and of course we got this information later on. While I was on duty there, we got no debriefings on any of the activities involving the shutdowns. But later on, when we requested information from the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act, we did get documents, and I have interviewed other witnesses talking about the investigation. I interviewed the chief investigator of Boeing, and he stated that they evaluated all the systems, did a very thorough investigation, found no palpable cause for these shutdowns, and they were going to write a report stating that, and the Air Force told them not to. Told them not to write a report. They were ordered not to. And as of 1972, they were still investigating that 1967 incident. They were still trying to figure out what had happened.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
well, I guess they couldn't figure out a way to include the activity of the UFO in the report. So it's just... And they
They had an oblique comment in the quarterly report to SAC headquarters. It stated in that report, and this was in 67, in the middle of 67, it stated rumors of UFO discounted or
discredited.
Some words to that effect. I can't remember exactly, but they did mention the word UFO, which was kind of funny in there. So there were, they acknowledged that there had been rumors, so-called rumors of UFOs, but these were more than rumors. There are four of us that are still alive, myself and my commander, Fred Meinwald, and the two crew members at Echo Flight, who can swear, if need be, to a congressional committee that they had reports of UFOs from the security guards, and they lost 10, we all lost 10 missiles from our launch control facilities. Immediately during and after those reports. So I think we've got a pretty good case. We've got a lot of written documentation and witness accounts. It's all circumstantial, of course, but even circumstantial evidence is proof in a court of law.
Well, it sounds a lot more plausible than somebody tripping over the extension cord. I mean, those systems have backups and backups, and I've not been down in a silo, but I've certainly been all over the top of them, and they are their own freestanding control system, and they just, one going down might, you know, be almost a court-martial offense, but 20 going down is a system-wide failure that's got to be caused by something.
Right, and the Air Force sent out a telegram the next morning. And we've got a copy of that telegram stating that it's an extreme concern to the command, the National Air Force, in this case Strategic Air Command, extreme. They use very harsh words like extreme concern as to why these missiles went down for no apparent reason. And those words are that's almost verbatim from the telex that went out from SAC headquarters to their contracting facilities.
So you think the Joint Chiefs heard this story at some point or another? I know I'm just asking, I'm just speculating. I'm not saying you were there, but a system-wide failure like this that just fundamentally takes down a whole section of our defense system, or in, as some would consider our offensive system, had to go to the very top.
Yes, I would agree.
Wow. Well, Robert Salas, Captain, former Captain of the Air Force, Robert Salas, I wish I could attend the conference, as do millions of other people, but if you had one message to deliver to those who may not get a chance to hear your words live, what would it be?
It would be that we need to re-energize the effort to have total nuclear disarmament, and every one of us can do our part. We've tried since the end of World War II to send out the message that these weapons are extremely dangerous to us, and And we don't, it's not time to give up now. We have to keep trying. We have to keep trying to spread that message. And as best we can, that we've got to eliminate nuclear weapons.
I think in its day, mutually assured destruction, our policy of mutual annihilation between the Soviet Union and the United States sort of kept the war from happening. But now, with the possession of weapons of these types by nations, or at least leaders of nations, who have no compunction about being destroyed in a war, I don't think that mutually assured destruction policy would actually work with them.
No.
So
nuclear deterrence is a non-starter. It's a non-issue. There is no nuclear deterrence. So, you know, the technology is out there. Obviously, you know, if we have North Korea, Iran, you know, wanting the technology, having the technology, we're not going to stop the technology spread. What we have to do is start cooperating as a world body and make sure that we, and the U.S. has to take the lead on this. We've got to take the lead because we've got more weapons than anybody else. We've got 6,000 nuclear weapons ready to launch right now. And the world as a whole has about 15,000 nuclear weapons, anywhere from 10 kilotons to 1.5 megatons. And it's a very dangerous time.
Well, I remember those days. I remember hearing the emergency broadcast system when it was first brought online. It wasn't for weather. It wasn't for tornadoes or hurricanes. It was for imminent nuclear attack. And I remember living in Southern California, hearing that alarm going off and sitting in my Southern California living room with my mother and having her say, well, I guess... you know, about 28 minutes is all we've got. And about 5 minutes later, they came back on and said it was a false alarm. But for those 5 minutes, I remember they were very long 5 minutes.
Yeah, yes.
Well, listen, Robert Salas, we appreciate you appearing with us this evening. I wish you great success with the conference, and I know that we'll be hearing again from you very soon.
So, my pleasure.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we will take a 48-second break, and then we will bring on our second keynote speaker, Paola Harris, and she will join Michael Sala and myself for about 30 minutes. They hear you.
Hello.
Hello, Paola. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio.
Okay.
I'm going to play about 4 minutes of commercials, and we'll be right with you, so hang on.
All right.
Hi, Paola.
Hi.
Brooks Agnew here with X-Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future Earth events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase with a $5 discount. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X-Squared Radio today.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. And there is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me. You will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You just might save the planet. Plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here, author of The Ark of Millions of Years. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service, so you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have neat gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I think we still have Michael Sala on the line, and now we have Paola Harris. She is the author of the book, Connecting the Dots. In it, she presents 26 disclosure interviews, mostly with former military, intelligence, and NASA personnel as they discuss their personal involvement in the UFO phenomenon. She has a master's degree in education, and I believe from my reading of her biography that she is dedicated to incorporating our role as a species in the community of worlds into meaningful curricula for school children of our planet. Paola, how are you this evening?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for asking me to speak.
Oh, my pleasure. I wish I could attend the conference, as do millions of other people, but this is the next best thing
and hopefully we'll inspire some people to get down there and see your conference next weekend.
Well, I think it's a very important moment in history because I think we need to make a few choices in the world. And being a journalist and living in Rome, because I do live in Rome 9 months out of the year, Rome, Italy, I think that the most important thing for mankind is to be informed.
Oh, I agree with that totally. So do you believe that it's about time we face the reality that the rest of the neighborhood exists?
Well, yes. Not only that, that we get rid of the ridicule factor and the fear, because I think that most people, and especially the younger generation, is ready now for a reality to understand that we are part of a galaxy. We are cosmic citizens in this galaxy, and that we need to make a few decisions based on information and accurate information. And that's really what my role is, and that's really what the role of a good journalist is, I think.
I see. Now, what does the term disclosure mean in your work?
Well, disclosure means that those people, and I call them the very, very courageous people, that have had some kind of firsthand experience, and we're dealing, in this case, with the UFO phenomenon or the presence of the extraterrestrial presence on the planet, those people that have courage to come forth and talk about their involvement, like Colonel Philip Corso that wrote the book The Day After Roswell,
mm-hmm.
That information should go into the public mainstream so that people understand they are making decisions for the future based on the fact that we've never been alone, we're not alone, that Roswell did happen, that we are heavily involved with an ET presence, not just in the United States, but since I live in Europe, I'm very, very familiar with what's happening in Europe. And that we, that this could be a cause for joy instead of for fear.
Well, that's the way I feel, too. But I don't think there's a person on Earth who believes that the government has told us what they know about the existence of UFOs. But I know people who still say, until I see one myself, I can't believe.
Well, I've never seen one, Brooks, and I've been working in this field for 30 years. I used to work with J. Allen Hynek, the famous astronomer who was a professor at Northwestern. So I take the word of these professionals, these very credible scientists, the astronauts. I have an interview with Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14, that will be on my website soon. I take their word for it. My seeing a light in the sky does not make it real, but my speaking with the people involved does.
Right. Well, make sure to tell us the name of your website so that our listeners can bookmark it and go there and learn more.
Yeah, well, my website is www.paolaharris.it for Italy.
Ah, excellent. Well, is there any plausible way to deny that UFOs exist?
Well, certainly. The biggest way, and since I live between this culture and the European culture, what I find when I come into the United States is that it becomes a ridicule situation, that it is not comfortable for people to come forth, that any kind of conference that usually is here is more of an esoteric type everything thrown in conference, where when we have a conference in Europe, and I attended one in Switzerland, it is we're dealing with unidentified flying objects. We're not dealing with little green men or gray aliens. We're dealing with a phenomenon. I find that there are scientists and serious people, and nobody laughs, and everybody just wants to know.
Yeah, we just want to know. I mean, we don't have a whole show to discuss this, but do you think there is evidence that the UFOs come from other worlds?
Well, from the 30 years of my research, the problem with saying other worlds, it takes the scientists, it gives the scientists ammunition to say that we haven't traveled light speed. Whereas if you say that they come from other dimensions, and we know for a fact with quantum physics, we live in a dimensional world, almost 11 dimensions, then you can really work with that a lot better. The fact that they appear and disappear in the same spot does not mean they went anywhere. It means that they are traveling interdimensionally through what we call wormholes or dimensional gates, which science is catching up to prove right now.
Yeah, we know a little bit about wormholes, but only theoretically. We, you know, my colleagues and myself, we mathematically treat the idea of wormholes, and you know, we've thought about the exotic material it would take to support one on the inside or the outside, and we kind of know that it would take a lot of energy and a lot of gravity to make one form. We don't know how stable they would be, but I do know that Sandia Labs is testing what's called a hypothetical device, and if it's successful, it could result in an engine that could get us to Mars in 8 hours and to the nearest star system in about half a dozen days.
That's exciting.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I want to see how that comes forth. I can't help but think of of the Star Trek movie, I think it's First Contact, when they figure out warp drive for the first time. I think that's about the limit that we're at right now. We've gone about as fast as we can go by burning hydrogen peroxide into water. And I think it's time to take it to the next level. But so is there any evidence that the UFOs come from our world?
Well, that's part of the dilemma we have in exopolitics. I'm sure Michael Sala's explained to you what exopolitics is. Part of the dilemma is we don't know what's our equipment and what's their equipment, because I think we have back-engineered our aviation to such an extent that what we could be looking at is our back-engineered material, and that would be very, very dangerous, because if we're going to be recording sightings or shooting at anything, we may be shooting at our own material.
Mm.
So I think that, yes, that if you're talking about underground bases, underwater bases, yes, there's an argument for that. And there's Richard Sauter, who's written on that. If you're talking about identifying craft that could be our craft, that is a dilemma, and that's part of the exopolitics problem that we're in protocols that we're discussing at this conference. As far as they're coming and going, in Mexico City, Jaime Maussan, who's an incredible journalist, has photographed very strange openings in the sky that he calls some kind of dimensional gates. They look like eyes in the sky. And it, you know, if people would just do a scholarly research on this subject, we could all join with Mexico and all over the world enough material so it would make some sense out of this phenomenon.
Well, hopefully your conference will help precipitate that. I know you can't use the word disclosure too much without running into the Disclosure Project, which was founded by Dr. Stephen Greer, and I had the opportunity to speak to him last December 18th, and I asked him directly, do we have craft that can make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour? And he said yes.
Yes, I believe that. We've seen some of that. I have some of that on film, actually, from Europe. So I have that I am positive is our craft and not UFO craft. It presents a problem. I helped Stephen Greer with his disclosure project because I don't know if people know, but his witnesses were not only from the United States, but there were military witnesses in Italy and in England that he also photographed, that he also documented.
I strongly recommend people make their way one time or another to his website, disclosureproject.org, and try to keep current on that information. So have we found out why, if we possess this kind of technology, that we don't display it in wartime or share the benefits of its energy source in a way that could help us graduate from the use of fossil fuels?
Well, you know, I don't want to even get in. I don't talk about this very much because I'd rather talk about the evolution of man getting along on Earth before we go to meet aliens in space, but the obvious is the obvious. This planet is run on economic, on an economic system where we have four wars over our fossil fuels, and we have power over our fossil fuels. And I think during the Cold War era, the United States in general had this technology. I think that they didn't want to share with the Russians or the rest of the world. I mean, it is top secret. It is a top secret situation. I think the whole key to the UFO phenomenon is the technology. It certainly isn't the aliens. It's keeping the technology at home and not having some rogue nation grab the technology and use it against us. I think that's the military mind rationalization for keeping the secret secret. I don't know if you agree.
I don't know if I agree or not. You look in history and look at the proliferation of weaponry. When one side gets it, it's only a matter of time before the other side gets it. No war is really, you know, I mean, battles are won, but wars aren't really the end of everything. I know there is this macroeconomic leadership that doesn't want to relinquish control of its rare and expensive energy supply. I know, I just filled up my truck. But full disclosure would put that technology in the hands of so many people that stopping its introduction into the world's ecosystem would be impossible.
But how you get them to pay for it, this is a problem. I think that we have limited fossil fuel. I think we have a couple of 30 years or 40 years from what the experts are saying, and then the technology will probably come forth. But how do you charge somebody for that?
Well, we get right back to the basic core of it. You know, is there any truth to the Brookings Institute fear that rendering the burning of oil obsolete would cause the collapse of the global economy? I don't think so. I think that the fact that we have to pay for energy that may be free and easy to obtain on a local level without centralized processing is the goal. Otherwise, we have the same economic control over our world that we have right now, and that is you can't get a phone unless you go through certain people. You can't get electricity to your home unless you go to the people that own the wires. You can't fill up your car unless you go to the, you know, pay the price of what a gallon of gasoline costs. And it's all routed back to, you know, billions upon billions of dollars flowing into the hands of a few people. But decentralizing all that, allowing third world nations to be able to generate their own electricity, clean their own water, provide lifting capabilities so that they can do engineering work on their own. This is the goal of a planet.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I'm in your camp here, and I really herald your courage to say these things. My greatest interview was Paul Hellyer, ex-minister of defense in Canada. I have a DVD with his interview. He has written several books on economics saying exactly what you're saying.
Oh, really?
And, yes. And he, I think one of them is called The Evil Empire. He's written at least 10 books on economics saying exactly the words that you just said. And when I did the interview with him, he is very much into the mindset that the hundreds and thousands and millions and billions of dollars going into the military-industrial complex and into the fossil fuel industry could do so much more to benefit a sustainable future for planet Earth. And his interview was astounding, where he actually did use the word UFOs, and he did want proof, he said, of what, you know, we intend to shoot at, if it's hostile or not hostile. And he believed that we should forge cooperation in space, and he believed that we should make the first move to have a non-violent type of meeting with whoever is visiting us. Now, this man has a tremendous amount of courage, and he will be in Hawaii at this conference.
Wow, that is really going to be exciting. I implore anybody, certainly within driving distance of the conference, to attend. But if you have plans on being in Hawaii on vacation, I would recommend that you spend the weekend at this conference, because it's gatherings like this and the tremendous financial risk and professional risk that these people take to put on these kinds of live sources of information that will change the world.
And if
these are no small events, to be sure.
I'd like to add there that
I agree with you 100%, and I thank you for your, you know, passion at being part of that. Because I think, as I asked Paul Hellyer, he said that it was a grassroots level, and grassroots means everyday people. It'll never come from the top up. It's going to come, from the top down. It'll come from the bottom up. People
yeah.
that have passion to change this situation.
Right. I think Michael had a comment. He's in the background there.
Yes, if you can hear me. Basically, I think what Paul Halliott does is he brings out the policy implications of what has been happening behind the scenes. Because he does have that pedigree as a politician, he's able to see the policy issues, and that's very important here because no one has been raising the policy issues. I mean, how ethical is it to basically develop advanced space weapons and target extraterrestrial vehicles without any informed public debate about this? I mean, he asks that question. I mean, he's one of the first to actually raise that and make it an important issue. And I think this is why I'm thrilled that he's coming out to the conference, because he's going to bring this out as a policy issue. It's not a question of, well, are there lights in the sky? Is it real? What does this signify? Are we being visited? He's bringing up the very real policy questions, such as, do we target these extraterrestrial vehicles with these advanced space weapons? And who makes those decisions? And why isn't the public in the loop? So this is vital, and Paul Halliott is doing a great service in coming forward to raise these policy issues.
Exactly. Well, I know that up until, well, let's say 20 years ago, all the weapon systems designed on this planet were designed to kill one another so that one nation could either defend itself or attack another. But about 20 years ago, we started perfecting and at least researching space-based weaponry. And some of this is based on Earth, and we actually launch it or reflect it from space. And other weapon systems are actually placed in space. And although, at least as far as the news media is concerned, we've never actually demonstrated these weapon systems, I kind of find that hard to believe myself. If we have it, we have a tendency to use it. But some of what you say is daunting to me, that we would actually build a weapon system to attack a craft or a civilization that's not from this planet.
Well, that is, that is the next scenario. I mean, I think that Wernher von Braun is quoted as saying that the next, we have to invent the next enemy, because war makes money, as we all know, and the next enemy would be an invasion from outer space of some kind, or a what we call a staged invasion. And so I think that Paul Halliott talks about that. A missile shield, he's talking about that in my interview. He said, a missile shield against whom? He said, Canada is going to put money together for a missile shield. We need to know who we're shooting at, if they're hostile, and whatever. And he based a lot of what he feels on Colonel Philip Corso's book. And having known Corso personally, Colonel Corso reinforced the fact that, that there were alien populations that that they did visit the planet, and that we had back engineered their their technology.
But is there any evidence that they come here with armed forces to subdue us?
No, there isn't, and that's the problem. There is no evidence. But when you're dealing with fear, people have a perception out of fear, because we're fear-based. Most people are fear-based. And we have this question of shoot first and ask questions later. And that is exactly, I think, what all of us journalists, researchers, and so forth are trying to avoid.
I know I'm former military myself. I served one tour in the Air Force. I didn't make a career of it, but we were speaking to Robert Salas earlier, and both of us served in the Air Force. And I can tell you from meetings that I've been in and briefings that I've been in that activities of UFOs blocking the launches of missiles or interfering with the command and control systems is seen as a clear and present danger. And, we're talking about fear of the public. Let's talk about fear of the men who are wearing the stars on their shoulders.
Fear, I think we can even add confusion, because they don't know what they're dealing with. I mean, it's very difficult. In Italy, we're dealing with a phenomenon in Sicily that's balls of light, and nobody knows what to do there, and they've blocked off the area, and it's very strange. It's confusion. People aren't real clear about who, and let's get off the stereotype of the gray alien that's been put as a refrigerator magnet in almost every home. I mean, in this kind of thing, it is their visitors, of many different planets or many different places or dimensions. And it is, there's not enough information to make decisions from. And that's exactly my personal point, is the more information I can give the general public, and this is with my interviews and with my book and so forth, the more information, the more informed we are. Now, it can't be that everybody is good. I don't think that everything is benevolent, but I don't see any visible proof that we've had hostile kinds of interactions with alien races.
Well, we might have had a visitor or two, and we may have had one perform defensive maneuvers as they've been attacked by chase planes, but I haven't seen fleets of UFOs coursing across the ocean toward a coastline and be met by groups of fighter jets. It's one here and one there, and sort of an obscure story here and a blurry photograph there, but it seems like, at least from what I can gather, and I don't think it's because I've just heightened my interest in the last few years. I've been interested in this subject for over 40 years. It seems as though we're sort of reaching a crescendo, that there may be some event nigh unto global first contact coming up.
I get that feeling, too. It's very strange. I'm getting that feeling, but I think it's connected with our nuclear toys. I think because of the interviews I've done, especially during the testing, the French testing in Polynesia, I had one witness tell me that they had UFO flyovers where they chased the UFOs on the island of Sangatofa in Polynesia. When I hear where they appear, it's connected with the idea that if we play with these dangerous toys, they might have consequences in other dimensions and might affect their civilizations.
Yes,
and if it affects their civilizations, they're going to be concerned.
Sure. I mean, there's no question that heavy gravity events and the detonation of gamma weapons does cause a very powerful gravity event. It does have pulse effects in multiple dimensions. That can be mathematically proven. But we don't know what those effects are. I think it would be quite surprising to be sitting in the park having milk and cookies, and all of a sudden a burst of gamma rays come through another dimension into your world. That would be rather disconcerting, I think. So I don't know exactly what the ramifications are of nuclear weapons in those worlds, but for 40 years or so, it seemed that nuclear weapons were in the hands of reasonable men. And now they are not. They're in the hands of madmen, and that may be quite alarming to them.
I'm sure it is, and I think that is the key, because if you do the study of where most of the sightings are, and most of the, especially probably Robert Salas's testimony confirms this too, what we might be considering an act of war or an act of aggression may be really, in effect, an act of peace.
Yes, exactly right. Wow, I wish we had a whole show just to talk to each one of these guests. My guest has been Paola Harris, and her website again is
www.paolaharris.it, because I'm a journalist who lives in Italy, so IT is Italian.
Very good. I appreciate you so much coming on the program. And I wish you great success in your speaking next weekend. I wish I could be there.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure, absolutely. All right, we will take another about 45-second musical break, have a few commercials, and then we will bring on our next guest, Mary Rodwell. So don't go away.
there is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are we are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Brooks Agnew here, author of The Ark of Millions of Years. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service, so you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have neat gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We do still have with us Michael Sala in the background and our guest, Mary Rodwell.
She is the author of Awakening, How Extraterrestrial Contact Can Transform Your Life. I have not a little emotion tied with the appearance of this guest, although I have never met her. Now, she is a registered nurse, but she has a field of treatment and support that is perhaps unique in the world. Welcome, Mary. How are you?
I'm very well, and good afternoon, Brooks.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Your award-winning documentary, your book, and your presence in this conference with such a powerful and life-altering subject treats the human-alien interaction on a unique plane. Can you describe the range of encounters experienced by people with whom you have worked?
Certainly. In brief, it goes from the really terrifying right through to people who believe that they're already connected with the visitors, as they call them, or their family, and actually find human beings quite alien. And what on earth are they doing down on this planet with such strange primitive creatures that want to kill one another? So as you can see, it's right from, oh my goodness, you know, what am I doing being taken, to what am I doing down here? So it is a really broad range of experience.
Wow, that kind of hits home with me a little bit. I've kind of felt that way my whole life. What the heck am I doing here, and why in the world would people want to hurt one another? It actually makes me physically ill to see it.
Mm.
So we're not just dealing with abductions here, are we?
No, contact seems to happen on an individual basis in a unique way. For some, only out of the 1,200 cases that I've had, I would say only 20 to 30% would be traumatized. And for them, often it's because they don't know what's going on. And when they have a chance to explore it and understand it more, many of them will change their attitude to their experiences. So it really is, certainly in my data and my cases, I'm not getting, you know, the percentage traumatized at all, but more support to deal with the fact that they feel very, feel very different to everybody else, and they want to feel like that, you know, they can connect with others that feel the same way. They feel very isolated and very alone, and as I say, almost connected more to, you know, their space family than they are to their human family.
Mm. So if 20% feel as though they've been traumatized, then that means 80% do not feel that they've been traumatized. They have sort of a soul connection with a family that's not here?
Yes, it actually was quite fascinating for me, because coming in as a counselor therapist, I believed that anyone that had this kind of experience initially was going to be traumatized and would need help and support to meet others so that they could feel less isolated, and helping them basically talk about it openly without judgment and to understand it in any way that they chose to. But what I discovered was that that was really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the experience, that there was such an enormous range of understanding with this. And for most, I certainly found a completely different attitude to it. Like, you know, yes, we're down here, we've got something to do. I really don't like humans very much, but I'm part of the human species at the moment. And really dealing with that conflict between their human self and that part of them that feels, if you like, extraterrestrial or not from here.
Mm. So do you find that that genetic lines of people are involved in these encounters, or is it a matter of being in the right place at the right time?
It's a very good question, Brooks, and the bottom line is that it seems to be intergenerational. And what I found is, for every client that I've had in a family that is experiencing this, it's often you'll find the siblings, parents, grandparents, and grandchildren actually are all having encounters. And this is what takes it away from psychological illness, in a sense, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't have a mass hallucination for an experience like this. When whole families can sometimes remember being on the craft together, you've got to say that something very real is going on.
Wow, that is amazing. So, would you say that the human genome is somehow tied into alien genetics, or do you think that it's just a social involvement?
Well, if you look at our history and how limited our understanding of history is, archaeologically and anthropologically anyway, we have got the missing link, and we have 223 genomes. that are not in any other species on the planet. And I actually talked to a gentleman who worked with Dr. Francis Crick, as you know, was the co-founder of the DNA molecule. And he talked about these 223 genomes, and he said to me, this gentleman, Mary, there is no other species on the planet, literally, that has this. And it's a sideways insertion of genetic material. It does not come up the invertebrate phase of our evolution. So you've got to say, how did it get there? And when we know that UFOs and strange beings have been drawn on cave drawings and seen, you know, on all this artwork right through history, including medieval religious paintings where you've got, you know, UFOs and other images that look like astronauts, you know, you've got to say, you know, put two and two together and say, well, we've been visited all through our history. Some of our mythology talks about these beings, the gods, as they call them, coming down and interbreeding with humans. So you've got to say that maybe that wasn't just symbolic, that in fact it was a reality, and this is what they're actually talking about.
Well, you know, there's quite a bit of evidence that natural selection or evolution of proteins does occur, but DNA is actually the designer of the proteins themselves, and although proteins might evolve, DNA is definitely an engineered molecule, and you go all the way back to the Zohar, and you see very detailed drawings of the double helix and its function long before, you know, modern biology got a hold of it. And these 223 genes, by some researchers, have even been claimed to be the very breath of life that makes mankind what he is on this planet. But I agree with you. I think that that the DNA with which Adam was made and thus we are built, I think it contains the materials for a higher race than the one that currently conducts war on this planet.
At least they're saying that it actually that 223 genomes is 25%. It actually is all to do with higher psychological functioning. And that is what makes the difference between us and the chimpanzees, is with these particular genomes.
Right. Well, I think I would like to see us interact with one another with more benevolence. And it does seem that generally society, I don't want to really use percentages, but I'll say 98% of society seems to want to obey the law, or, you know, want to at least have some kind of social peace. But there are 2% that, you know, they occupy our prisons and our back alleys, and I think, unfortunately, they rise to power in our world and commit war against one another. I don't understand it, but why, well, there just seems to be a separation between those that would charge across the frozen tundra at one another with battle axes in their hands and those of us that would rather get along with everybody.
I think there's a very interesting question here that comes out of the data that shows that when there is interaction with extraterrestrials, that individuals come out of that often with heightened abilities and more developed psychic abilities. So it does seem that interaction with extraterrestrials does kick in some genetic disposition that we have to use heightened abilities that are all innate within us. And I think this is something that Mary has been working on, and I'm looking forward to her presenting at the conference, where she actually does describe her data, which is very extensive, that does point out this heightened ability that is innate within us that is brought out by interaction with extraterrestrials.
I don't know if you heard the question or not, Mary.
Not completely.
Yeah, he was commenting on your work, clinical and maybe otherwise, where experience with these aliens has a tendency to bring out a heightened abilities in the human to have maybe telepathic abilities or more benevolent feelings toward one another, but it seems to heighten the mental abilities of the human.
That's absolutely right, and that was what was quite mind-blowing to me initially, was to find that when people were in a place of trust and openness where they could explore this and understand it, there was a transformative process going on where they opened up, often with high sensibilities, which, you know, go into telepathy and clairvoyance and clairaudience, and use ways of special ways of healing. So what seemed to happen is that more as they were able to integrate this multidimensional experience, the more they opened up to the multidimensional reality and were aware more of their connectedness to everything. They became very ecologically aware. They often changed their diet. They became more aware of a universal spirituality. And it was quite incredible to see the changes that occurred. And this was literally, I felt, that the experience of either seeing, the craft or actually going up onto the craft somehow acted as a catalyst or trigger to wake them up to this greater reality and for them to see the connectedness in all things, which was quite incredible, including some of the other sides to this, which are coming in with most amazing geometric artwork, scripts and languages that, as far as we know, do not have a human origin.
Wow. I really want to go to this conference. So the interaction between alien teachers and Earth-born humans, do you think it's designed to impart an intuition towards peace and freedom and oneness?
Well, the outcome of all these experiences ultimately seems to be transformative as far as I can see. There's a very, very small percentage and that I would say doesn't fit with that profile, and that's what makes it so overpowering.
Mm.
But what their message is from the extraterrestrials, when they see them on the craft, they're educated into taking care of the planet. They've said, they say to them, you can't do this to your planet anymore. Don't you realize what you're doing? You've got to take care of things, and you've got to take care of yourselves, and you've got to look at what you're polluting, because this is, your life, and this is the planet looks after you. And so when they have had these experiences, they become very passionate towards the environment. Some of them won't even kill a fly or an ant. They become quite passionate about any form of life or consciousness whatsoever. So for me, if that's the ultimate reaction to an extraterrestrial contact, you've got to say that it's, for most people, it seems extremely positive.
Well, I have met people who at times, even though as far as they know, they've never been taken up in a craft, they feel almost overwhelmed with feelings of benevolence toward all mankind for no apparent reason. Is, in your opinion, is there some kind of global message being broadcast by sources off-planet that are meant to be received by everyone but tuned out by those with a loud mind?
I think you're quite right. I think that from what I can see, certainly the benevolent ones that are interacting and leaving this impression, I think are working on consciousness. And they're working on the frequency of those that are ready to receive that kind of message of peace and harmony and connectedness to them and to all life. And that includes, our galactic neighbors and all intelligences. And this seems to be the constant theme all the way through, is that we've got to learn to grow up and stop being so aggressive. And of course, as Dr. Michael Sala knows, that we've had so much more interaction and sightings ever since we started, with the nuclear bomb. I mean, this was when everything went absolutely crazy. And they really seem to be accelerating human consciousness now on a level I think is unprecedented.
I think you're absolutely right. So how would you recommend that we prepare ourselves for the advent of global first contact?
I think with the message that we want to grow up, that we want to understand and appreciate all life, that we've got to get away from our judgments of everyone and to honor, love, and respect everything and everyone.
Well, I know there are stories of abductions and mutilations and breeding programs and DNA harvesting. So, I mean, are there good guys and bad guys coming here?
Look, it's a very hard one, I think, to create a mandate around, because obviously there are some people that have had very traumatic, very difficult experiences, and my understanding is that not all of that certainly can be related to perhaps our visitors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'll be quite honest with you. I can only go on the ultimate testimony of my clients and what they're saying to me. I do know that there's certainly a percentage that have been very, very traumatized, but from what I'm seeing, it's a very small percentage, and I don't know what's behind that. And I think it would be very arrogant of me to make a blank statement either way. All I can say is I don't know. I can only go on the testimony of those that have come to me, and for most of them, I'm talking about a high percentage, you know, 90% ultimately would say to me that, you know, they feel that what we're getting assistance, and it is benevolent. But, you know, I can't say more than that.
Well, I mean, as you said at the top of your appearance, that most people are not traumatized by this experience, but rather enlightened. And now, do you have any, I guess let me back up a little bit. Some of these experiences are not one-time things. They're having, you know, repeated meetings or exposures to off-worlders, and they're continually learning throughout their life. And I guess somewhere in that curve, you've met them. And so you're able to evidently track this growth in them from over their lifetime or over a period of years?
Certainly, with some of them. It's what really blows my mind, to be honest, Brooks, is the children. And they will come out with such things. And this is a five-year-old talking to his mother. I don't mind going through the walls, and they teach me more on the ships than I learn at school.
Wow.
And one day I'll introduce them to you.
That's a five-year-old?
This is a five-year-old talking about his experiences.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is what I do talk about in more in depth, is what the small children say about their understanding of what they learn on the craft. Mm-hmm. As one eight-year-old called it knowledge bombs in her head. And they seem to be taught a syllabus of anything from quantum physics to how to use their mind and energy. They are taught about our ecology. They're taught about the real history of the human race. And these are small children, and they come out with wisdom and awareness that would, well, actually blows my mind.
You know, in every age, there seems to have been a handful of individuals, at least the ones we found out about, like Einstein or Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo. They're much more capable, much more aware, much more advanced than their current society. And I think the reason that we've only seen a handful of them over history is because of the isolation of knowledge to those people. But now, today, all knowledge is available pretty much to everybody who can assimilate it. And I think that that the appearance of this technology, the appearance of off-worlders trying to heighten our ability to be wise with that knowledge, we're going to see great sweeping changes in our planet in a very short amount of time. Do you feel that way as well?
Oh, absolutely. And it is a really hopeful and positive note, because it's what I'm understanding of what I call the Star Kids is anywhere near online, we are getting a generation or two or three generations, perhaps, ultimately, that are bringing in this awareness that we only need 10% to change the consciousness of the planet. That's
right.
All. And if we get 10%, then the whole of humanity's consciousness has to change with that. And that's what I think is actually going on now. It's the program's been accelerated, and more of these children are being born everywhere across the globe. And they're bringing in this understanding. They're born aware, these new children. And as one Star Kid said, they're born without programs, so they're not influenced in the same way the old model, which is moi, you know. I think I still have to go up the gears, as it were, where they're the automatics. And this is what is incredible. We're seeing these kids all over the world, 3- and 4-year-olds that know how to heal. And it's the most exciting time, and I think we should all be very, very hopeful about the future, ultimately.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, I'd like to add that this is where the world peace element comes in, because when we do have a global environment which is based on peaceful cooperation between different nations and with the star visitors, then we have the opportunity for consciousness to grow in a positive direction, and that is going to be critical for us as a civilization to be able to use these advanced technologies, because there is a mind technology interlink here,
which is very critical for understanding how these advanced technologies operate. So we need to lift our global consciousness and our individual consciousness to better use these, and this peaceful environment is going to be really critical for that.
Well, and conferences like the one that you're going to have next weekend, I think, are critical to that as well. I think I agree with this criticality of 10%. You know, we are beginning to come up on election year. We're in a midterm election, and one party or the other talks about manipulating or holding on to various bases. But none of those are even close to 10% of the society. If truly 10% of the society becomes aware, and I'm going to use the word cognizant, they become self-aware in the universe rather than a manipulated voting pawn, maybe our governments will change and we'll be able to break down the barriers that we have between one another that are led by various banners and creeds which ostensibly right now call for the annihilation of someone else's creed or society. So hopefully we're getting to the point where mankind is ready to make this metamorphosis. I am highly encouraged by your clinical work, and especially your report here today, and I wish I could attend the conference, but I'm sure that we'll be talking again, and I appreciate very much you coming on the program this evening.
You're very welcome, Brooks. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Yes, I feel the same way. And do you have a website that people can
go to? Yes, it's very simple. It's www.maryrodwell.com, and there's two L's on the end of Rodwell.
Maryrodwell.com with two L's. All right, we'll make a note of that. I'll post all of these websites on X Squared Radio's homepage, and we will try to raise the consciousness as much as we can to your cause, both up to and after this upcoming conference. So I wish you success with it, and my heart goes with you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. We will take another 45-second musical break as my producer brings on Neil Freer, who is our next guest. Thank you very much. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio.
There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Did you know that 11 of the 12 sets of footprints on the moon were made by Eagle Scouts? It's true. Soon, men and women will be doing the real moonwalk. But just so we don't forget, the first footprint on the moon has been replicated in a limited edition plaque that would make the perfect gift for a court of honor. Maybe you need something special for your office or your library at home. This high-quality plaque can add that something special that lets people know how excited you are. We are returning to the moon. Visit Countdown Creations at X Squared Radio today and order your limited edition First Step on the Moon plaque. Brooks Agnew here, author of The Ark of Millions of Years. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service, so you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have neat gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew, your host. This is where the past meets the future.
Our next guest is Neil Freer. He is the author of the book Breaking the God Spell. He is perhaps more outspoken on the evolutionist-creationist conflict than anyone on Earth today. He holds a B.A. in English and did graduate work in philosophy and psychology at the New School for Social Research. Welcome, Neil. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So good to have you on the program. You mentioned a coined term in one of your papers by Dr. Timothy Leary. What is a futant?
A futant, that term is a combination of mutant and futurist, or futant. A futant basically is defined as genetically programmed, like others are programmed to be different things. 1 or 2% of the population at any given time who is proclivity to be an evolutionary scout.
Wow.
Experience the future, come back and respectfully do the dance for the hive to say, you know, this looks like the best trajectory, and that's where the honey is.
So travel out in beyond the arrow of time, experience something, and bring it back to the present.
Yes.
Wow, which is their path, and then try not to look too weird when you're doing it.
You do have to watch your back.
Well, I know one thing. After a few decades of turning companies around from certain financial death, conflict is inevitable. So it is how we deal with conflict that makes the difference. These futants are faced with more than their fair share of conflict because they are a human anomaly. So how does this interaction with society expose them?
So I think Giordano Bruno, 16 years before Harvard was founded, as a basically a Bible college, was burnt at the stake for suggesting that, you know, it looks like there's probably other planets and stars and stuff out there that might have inhabited stuff, and so they barbecued them. So you do learn to watch your back, and it, you know, the authority spell is pretty heavy, especially in Western culture.
Yes, and I've noticed that myself.
Yeah,
I was actually doing an interview for my second book, and I was taking a sort of man on the street survey, and I was asking people a series of questions like, do you believe in UFOs? Do you believe there's life on other planets? These kinds of real simple questions. And somebody asked me a question, which I'll tell you what the answer was in a minute, but they said, are you an alien? And of course my answer was, hey, I'm asking the questions here. So
good move, good defensive move.
So these futants, do they all find their way in this world, or is there sort of a natural selection process like anything else?
Well, I think there's a white paper I have published on my website, neilfreer.com, which is actually titled Sapiens Rising. Which is I'm brash enough to put out a manual for futants, how to recognize yourself. It's mostly self-selection because you are only 1.5 to 2% of the population. I distinguish between a futurist and a futant. I mean,
what's the difference?
A futant is always a futurist, but a futurist is not necessarily always a futant. Futurists tend to be counterpunchers. In the sense that they search for all the unexpected wild cards and try to warn everybody ahead of time and then try to figure out some way to react against them, whereas a futant tends by a genetic programming to experience the future and come back and report. So, yeah. There is probably a lot of suffering on the part of futants because currently I think futants as such are not recognized we are confused enough about ourselves generally. You know, the planet's all damn near on standstill because, you know, the criteria crunch. We've got science, philosophy, theology, and the New Age, all with a different set of criteria to judge what reality is. And the bottom line is we don't really have a consensual, planetary-wide definition of what a human being is. We kill each other over it. You know, that's pretty into.
That's exactly right. I mean, what is the definition of a human being? You know, I as a former scoutmaster, I'm exposed to young boys with vivid imaginations, and you know, those campfire discussions with leaders and scouts talking about stars and planets. You'd be amazed at some of the things that come out. A futant, I'm just grasping it now. It would seem, if this is a genetic proclivity, that they begin showing these abilities at a very young age. It's not something that's trained into them by neighbors or teachers.
Well, yeah, you know, speaking only from my own personal experience and observing others who probably are have that same kind of programming, I didn't quite frankly know what the bloody hell was happening to me, why I always felt at ease in society in many respects. And I was also brought up as a Catholic and Dominican school and studied for the priesthood, and I was a Trappist novice for a while. So, you know, those are certainly negative contexts for Futin. And so I was always very grateful to good friend Tim Leary because, you know, Tim, let's face it, was the Tesla of psychology. And I was fortunate to live across the street from their place in Millbrook and become good friends and learned a tremendous amount from that man. But at any rate, that was before Gordon Liddy started to hide in the bushes to buy his ticket to Watergate in Millbrook, New York,
yes,
where he was the district attorney. You know, it gave me a context to begin to understand myself, and I've always appreciated that, and it's led me, no doubt, to be preoccupied as a futurist, as a philosopher, a stand-up philosopher, a generalist, to be preoccupied with our the biggest picture, and. That's the way I'm going to come at it in the Exopolitics conference that I'm looking forward to presenting at this next weekend in Kona, Hawaii.
I guess the real question now is: are all talk radio hosts futans?
a good defensive move on my part is to say that it's pretty much a process of self-selection.
Yeah. I've got you. Well, I recall a couple of events when I was a kid. I don't want to go into it on the radio, but it seemed as though that as we are schooled in government schools and we're told not to talk about things or not to be certain ways by our social mores, that we're sort of rationalized out of what reality really is. And I think when we run into conflicts with that later in our adult lives, we try to inebriate it in one way or another with alcohol or drugs or thrill-seeking or something. But it's clear that the childhood ability of these particular individuals is stifled by society and not really allowed to come out.
I think that's basically true. The religious context that we have, the absolute of religious faith, I think have, fortunately, one of the major advantages of living in our time is that we have been able to break that God spell of authoritarian, male-dominant, chauvinistic, slave code religions. Because we have, you know, the contribution of Zechariah Sitchin, the Sumerian scholar, who, in 1976 started to publish a series of books. I think men should get a Nobel Prize. He's the Darwin of our day. And he, you know, he, the only major difference between he and the rest of the archaeological community is that he says all of the evidence that we've accumulated over the last 150 years, particularly from the Middle East, points to one simple fact, and that is that the quote-unquote gods transculturally known to all the ancient civilizations were not mythological, and they were real, and furthermore, they were aliens, an alien civilization from the 10th planet in our solar system. And they genetically engineered us 200,000 years ago as a slave creature to work their gold mines at first in South Africa. And so we, you know, when we realize the implications of his thesis proven out overwhelmingly by the evidence from history, archaeological evidence, uparts, those out of place things in time that we can't explain, that are high tech science and astronomy. I mean, he met even with Harrington from the Naval Observatory, and they agreed, you know, that the information that they already had acquired from the IRIS satellite scan in 8384 and all the other astronomical information that had been accumulated, that the 10th planet, as recognized particularly by the IRIS infrared imaging satellite group, met all the criteria and had the same orbital path and characteristics, tip to the plane of the ecliptic and so on, as was given to us by the Anunnaki, our parent civilization that created us to be half them and half Homo erectus, as a bicameral species. You know, the evidence is overwhelming. So that, in a sense, gives us a major advantage, because currently we're literally being invited. I mean, some people would say, well, aliens are, we're being invited to stellar society. And rather politely, and with a good deal of patience.
Let's talk about that for a second. This nine planet mentality, where we've been created in 6 days from the depths of the earth. You know, you quote Alan Bloom, which wrote The Closing of the American Mind. He said the most successful tyranny is not the one that uses force to assure uniformity, but the one that removes awareness of other possibilities, that makes it seem inconceivable that other ways are viable, that removes the sense that there is an outside.
Correct.
It's so powerful, so poignant. When I speak to people and they say, well, how come, you know, we don't know about all this that you're talking about? How come we don't know there were giants on the earth? How come we don't know there were alien races that visited our planet? And you know, you begin your paper, the one that's entitled The Alien Question, by stating a paradigm. The alien presence paradigm should be seen as having two parts, separate but related. The first one is the recognition of the presence of an alien culture or cultures from outside our solar system and the ramifications that go with that. And the second one is the recognition and restoration of our true history as a genetically engineered species. So, you know, this is the kind of realization that the whole human race needs to know. But the source of our information, and I'm not an archaeologist, but my co-author is there's such a narrow mind, or sort of like a peer review system, that you're only allowed to come up with certain kinds of archaeology. And when did archaeology actually originate?
Well, it's fascinating. Archaeology as a science, as a discipline, is younger than our constitution because of the suppression of the information and warping of the information by basically the Roman Church and Western culture. We find that it wasn't until Schliemann, a merchant in Germany, broke open the case by saying, I I can't believe this is all mythology, and he went down and dug up a reasonable facsimile of Troy.
And when did that happen?
That was in the late 1800s.
Wow.
And so
archaeology didn't exist before 1800?
Well, not really, not as a discipline,
wow.
Because they, you know, there were tourists, so-called tourists from, you know, Europe, who would travel down there and bring back things that looked like very ancient and put them on their mantelpiece, but there was no real discipline because the Roman Church, controlling Western thought, really, would have it that, you know, the planet was created in 4004 BC at 9 o'clock in the morning, depending on which school of thought, you know, your Bishop Usher or whomever you're talking to.
And he was a member of our church.
Yeah. And so you know, there couldn't have been anything before 6000 BC or 4004 BC in this case. And so, it depends on that particular kind of suppression. And so it really, we don't see a discipline of archaeology emerging until finally the scholars, pushed by the amateurs, had to say, well, yeah, we knew it all the time.
I see astronomy doing the same thing today. Amateur astronomers are pushing astronomy. So how were we able to break away from the clutches of the church and begin to explore the world in which we live?
Well, I think it's fascinating to look back and see the whole picture of our development. I mean, one of the ways is I think really well given in detail and described by another author, a more recent author, Sir Lawrence Gardner, who wrote Bloodline of the Holy Grail, Genesis of the Grail Kings, whose work I consider him a good friend, and I highly recommend his work. Meticulous scholarship.
His books are for sale inside Roslyn Chapel in the bookstore.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah. And so, to try to give an overall picture, Sitchin produces this material. It is denied, and then finally, more recently, within the last few years, he actually has become good friends with Monsignor Balducci, who is from the Vatican offices, retired now, a confidant in the Pope, who has been talking about the alien phenomenon, UFOs and stuff, on TV for some time. And even though Monsignor Balducci maintains his Roman Catholic faith, obviously, he is still not poisoned or defrocked and obviously speaking for the Roman Church indirectly, and agrees with Sitchin in many respects. And Sitchin obviously respects his position. So we see a development there. And it's like the whole business of the creation of the world in 4004 BC, Bishop Usher's basic thesis, that was established as basically Roman Catholic doctrine for back in 1636, don't hold me to the date, and I remember distinctly that I happened to be a Roman Catholic seminarian in Baltimore in the seminary when that doctrine was quietly sort of withdrawn in 1952.
Wow. You know, in my imagination, I've sort of looked back to this day, and I see church leaders literally trying to figure out how to dismantle or bury the pyramids so people wouldn't ask them where they came from or who built them.
Oh, sure.
I think they're still trying to do that.
Well, you know, it's just like the other day, when the Da Vinci Code opened up, Sir Lawrence Gardner, who has written, I think, a definitive history of the entire Grail bloodline, starting with in Sumeria, generated literally by Enki, who was an Anunnaki, to give us foreman kings that were enhanced genetically. just about the time they created Sumer as a crash course in civilization, because the Anunnaki knew that they were going to phase off in a while. And that's where Sir Lawrence Gardner has made a major contribution, because he has unique access to the libraries of 30 royal families that he's been doing genealogical work for years in Europe. And he's been able to trace that bloodline back, which has come down to us through the heterodox stream of Christianity. Still exists in the Royal Scots. And we could even talk about why Princess Diana was killed, but we only have a few minutes here.
Exactly.
And one of the major contributions, having traced that bloodline and recognizing Sitchin's, Sir Lawrence Gardner recognizes Sitchin's work as not only valid but valuable, he was able to reinterpret the. Just as a single example of some of the benefits of these scholars' work, he's able to reinterpret the exploration and discovery of the temple on Mount Horeb, so-called temple, mm-hmm. that Sir Flinders Petrie found when he was working under funding from the Egyptian Exploration Fund around 1900, and which he was not allowed to publish about. It turns out, to make a very long story short, that Sir Lawrence Gardner, having traced the Starfire enhancement material from the Anunnaki females that was given to this the royal bloodline, the Grail bloodline, Graal, special bloodline in Sumeria, all the way up through the Egyptians, through the Essenes, through the Hebrews, and eventually through the heterodox tradition in Christianity. And Jesus and Mary in the process. The Da Vinci Code is, you know, they're cracking the shell of the egg, but Dan Brown doesn't have it right in the sense that he starts the bloodline with Jesus and Mary and so on.
Right.
He started all the way back in Samaria.
Sure.
So anyway,
can I ask a question?
I think Michael had a comment. Excuse me, Michael.
I'm sorry.
He's in the background there.
I just wanted to say that I think Neil's work really brings into the focus the importance of understanding what happens when we have to confront this extraterrestrial presence who have played a role in our making. I mean, his book, Breaking the God Spell, nicely presents the imperative here of knowing that we aren't to basically follow the past patterns of being subservient to these beings, that in fact that we have our own kind of genetic dispositions or gifts that we need to stand equal. And I think this is important because what we're seeing in terms of the response the secret government has to extraterrestrials is one of increased militarization. And what that comes from is a deep insecurity as to who we are and who these returning extraterrestrials are. And so if we understand our origins, if we understand our powers, our innate abilities, then we can deal with the return of the Anunnaki, the return of many different extraterrestrial races in a way where we don't precipitate some kind of conflict or create a drama with them. So I think Neil's work kind of brings that into focus, which is
mm-hmm.
why I think
mm-hmm.
it's such an important part of this conference coming up.
Well, I hope that this conference isn't the last of its kind. I know it's not the first. I've seen them out there. But, I suppose the church and even men have tired of shaking their heads in dismay. But I don't see any meaningful effort by anyone other than our guest today and perhaps a handful of others to find the answers to that question. You know, maybe, you know, we're assuming with our church mortal goggles that the answer lies somewhere in the sands around the pyramids themselves, but it's evident that the answer lies perhaps beyond this planet.
Well, you know, that's why I think it is important to understand that exopolitics, the interaction and negotiations, if you will, but interactions between the human species must be done as a species. It must also recognize, we should recognize that there are two parts to exopolitics. There are the intrasolar system politics of our resolution and relationship with the Anunnaki, our parent species, mm-hmm. so that we do, as Michael pointed out, become confident enough and unified and peaceful enough as species so that we can be matriculate into stellar society. And the other part is the extrasolar system exopolitics, where we're dealing with species from outside our solar system. And so, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conference because we need to bring this to the attention of the people, and we also need to bring it to the attention of the powers that be. I was invited to make a presentation along these lines at a think tank in Washington to a group of some 40 Pentagon brass a while back, and just the invitation to do that was startling. It was mind-boggling.
It does seem that maybe the ice is beginning to break if you got an invitation like that.
Yes, that's why I didn't know what to expect, and they sat through a 2-hour presentation and then blew the CEO of the think tank away by staying another hour to ask very intelligent and informed questions. And I thought to myself, this changes my perception of military intelligence.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of hope, and hopefully the powers that be become the powers that were. And those of us with more enlightened and more open view of man's place in the community of the galaxy are more real. And, I don't think we're alone in the universe. And I think, do you think the seeking of these answers is the destiny of mankind?
I think it's a passing phase, just like our seeking, our, you know, the Anunnaki purposely withheld extreme long lifespans, which was in their genetic code and which was their legacy from us. And so that's one of the reasons why, we're working hard towards immortality, and why nanotech is, put nanotech together with the fact that we're being invited to stellar society, that we're restoring it to ourselves, and also that we have knowledge now not only of the existence of the 10th planet as the solar system home of the Anunnaki, but as a potential threat for species extinction, which is tremendous leverage to make people sit up and take notice that we better get our act together here, because once that planet comes through at the wrong angle, at the wrong time when we're on the same side as the sun, the Earth is on the same side as the sun apparently, we can face literally species extinction. But nanotech, all these four major factors are interrelated and literally give us the opportunity for what John Peterson of the Arlington Institute think tank calls a grand moment. You know, we can get off the dime. We can achieve planetary unity. We can achieve planetary peace, and we can perhaps pass the SATs. Recognize that we're a young species, and pass the SATs and matriculate into stellar society.
Well, perhaps planetary unity can be achieved without one world government.
Yes, please.
Sometimes the chaos of men's greed and their lust for power is too much for us. It's a noise of murder and investment and manipulation and human management, and it seems to keep us in a physical and mental poverty from which we just cannot rise. The shackles of debt that enslave us, while the censures of freedom curse us. Drawing from your formidable gift as a philosopher, is there any tool that you can provide our listeners that will help them break the ice off their age and swim for the surface of the human race?
Wow. Do I have any scuba gear, huh? I think that it is inevitable that we will progress this way. I think that the very fact that exopolitics can be recognized as a a legitimate and powerful and beneficial study and protocol. You know, it wasn't long ago when the Brookings Institute said, don't tell anybody about the troubled military, don't tell anybody about the alien presence. And then now, everybody will panic. And now we have cartoons, you know, like of so-called Martians standing on Mars holding up a sign in front of the rover saying, go home, Yankees.
Well, now we also have a digital effects expert, John Gresh, who's completed a film called One Anunnaki, and it's getting ready to come. Well, it's coming out of production now, and he's got two more movies behind it. We're at least through work like this, really trying to raise the consciousness of the world.
Sure. And, you know, Dan Brown is helping a little bit. Sitchin has made a major contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And take it all the way back to friend Tim Leary. You know, if his stuff was way ahead of time, and he ended up as a futurist and a futurist and a psychologist, you know, being put through 15 jails as a political prisoner. You know, the old Giordano Bruno syndrome, a little bit milder. But we see now that there's probably 50-year periodicities that we can recognize. Things move so slow, and that's primarily why I'm signed up for cryogenic suspension. I'm a practicing immortal. You know, I this is the neatest universe I know about, and this planet is my planet, and there's a lot of us out there. I mean, it does look when you look at Fox Slime Time News or read the mainstream press that the entire planet's going down the tubes, but there's a lot of us, millions and millions and millions of people out here who are just playing it cool and know that our time will come. And
we all feel as though something grand is about to happen. You know, with futons fully empowered now by the access to all the knowledge, you know, on the planet at light speed, do you think there's hope for the human race? Do you think we'll survive to return to the stars, or do you think we'll end ourselves?
I'm very confident that by basic human nature, we are gradually actually discovering that we are not evolving Darwinianly, if there is such a word. We are a special case of evolution. We were invented as a genetic species, and we're moving in a much more accelerated pace. And once we break the Godspell, we can see that the trajectory of advanced species, demonstrated by those who have condescended to visit us and instruct us or contact us, even though we're pretty primitive yet, that the trajectory is towards compassion, cooperation, expansion of consciousness, and constant, open-ended evolution. And when we look around, you know, how many people quietly will admit if they think it's safe that, that's the way we want to go. We don't want war. We don't want killing, and the military is beginning to shape up that way too.
Well, that's really exciting. I hope that we are finally catching our breath and realizing who we are and what our potential might be.
And I hope that people will begin to not only think for themselves but to demand information for themselves. Because I believe that the information about the trajectory and incoming nature of the 10th planet, which is apparently Uranus size, when it passes in between Mars and Jupiter at perigee, the closest place in that slingshot around the sun that it does once every 3,600 years, can cause, as Alan and Adler in their book Cataclysm has given in great detail, when they describe what happened about 9,500 years ago. About 9,500 BC.
And they're great book. Awesome book.
Awesome book. Awesome book.
I've wanted to meet them for years. Alan and Dallaire wrote this phenomenal book. I mean, nobody dies. There's no plot. There's no heroine. But, oh, my goodness, you can't put it down. There's such excellent paleobiology and paleobotany in this book, and the cosmic reach and evidence that they have put in this book is just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to bring it right down to the bottom line here, exopolitics is maturing rapidly. There is adjustment. There's all kinds of expansion, and I'm working hard to contribute to, as Michael is, certainly, and all credit to Michael for initiating the Exopolitics Institute, and to our friend Weber, who has actually literally developed the term exopolitics, for bringing it into the realm of science, and into the area of sociology, because I think we need to become exosocial, and exopolitics is what exosocial people do, and what exopolitical ambassadors do, and we need to see the development of the UN. Or other worldwide planetary organizations of humanistic and human species-oriented. We have to go beyond religion. We have to go beyond politics. We have to go beyond civilizations or cultures or religions. And in order to enter society, stellar society, as a species.
Well, I guess the only fundamental worry that I have is the philosophy, at least with the UN, it appears, that there is a need to break down and rebuild the power structures that are already existing on the planet, instead of working with those power structures and you know, rethinking the origin of mankind, the purpose of life, and the purpose of borders and religions in the first place. It just seems like there's so much ethnicity and so much, you know, passion with which we wield scimitar and sword and rifle at one another for ridiculous reasons. And I just don't see that organization getting past that at all.
Well, you know, I think the development of new organizations or new functions seems to run in threes. We had the what was the original one? The United Nations, right? No, not the United Nations.
League of Nations.
The League of Nations, and then we have, and that worked sort of, and then it just went.
Yeah, greed overtook it, just the original banking systems.
Sure, and then the UN is currently in place, but being hogtied, hampered, and by the manipulations of various political entities. It's possible that we may have to start fresh and start an exopolitics kind of a planetary species-wide organization. And I'm up for that. And I think that people all over the world are up for that. You know,
if
I talk to people...
If we reach that 10% criticality that Mary was talking about, we'll be there.
You betcha.
10% of the population of Earth is a formidable force for peace, if you can handle that oxymoron. Well, listen, I have thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program. We've gone way over a segment, but you were the final one in the lineup, so you kind of got the most time, but I wish I had hours with you, and I wish that I could jump on a plane and be there next week at this conference, because I just know it's going to be fabulous. My guest has been Neil Freer, and his website again is neilfreer.com.
Neilfreer.com.
All right.
And thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. It's definitely a benefit. with the two networks that we have, and we keep these archives on our website for at least a year, and they're free, so we don't charge anybody to listen to them, and all your words will continue to go out. We flow quite a bit. People sit at their desks at work and listen to this program, which I think is amazing. I for one, am fascinated by it. So as a possible futant and talk radio host, I appreciate you being on tonight.
Thank you.
Michael, are you still there?
I'm still here.
All right. Well, if we Neil will go ahead and go his way, we can bring Michael on for the last 9 minutes here. And we'll raise your volume up so that we can have some concluding remarks. Wow, what a lineup you've got at this conference.
Well, it's a remarkable group of people, and everyone is going to be able to say a little bit about how their research on this whole phenomenon, the extraterrestrial presence, is going to give us an understanding of what we need to do to establish peaceful relations with them and also amongst ourselves.
Yeah, we haven't even scratched the surface with these guests tonight, and I'm sure that their presentations will include audiovisual and evidence and documents, and you need to go to their websites. If you haven't heard the whole program live, please go back and listen to the archive. Very, very valuable stuff here. This is changing the planet. And Michael, I appreciate more than you know. I know it's not just a personal risk, it's also a financial risk to put together conferences like this. And if we were successful in getting this rebroadcast on some AM stations there in the islands, maybe we can help you build your attendance at the conference.
Well, thank you, Brooke. I mean, it does make a difference getting the word out. And you, as you said, anyone involved in this field takes a risk. But I mean, we all get involved because we know that this is the truth, and we know that even if there is some short-term kind of financial loss or risk involved in any of the things we do, that at the end of the day, we play a role in helping this truth come out. And that is really satisfying, very satisfying at a deep level. And like yourself, who I know you've done a lot of work in getting this information out, and I mean, it really is gratifying to know that we're all part of a network, a global network, working together to get the truth out, and I think that really augurs well for the future because the challenges are enormous.
Yeah, well, it might go beyond that. I mean, do you think it's, I think it is, well, do you think it's vital to the human race that we come to terms with the fact that we are not from around here?
Well, this is it. We have incredible abilities. And, I mean, some I've seen it noted that we have as many as 22 different extraterrestrial races who have been involved in our genetic engineering. So it's more than just the Anunnaki, which I know they get a lot of attention because of Zechariah Sitchin's work. But we have evidence that there are many different extraterrestrial races who have played a role. So we're a kind of potpourri of the galaxy in terms of our genetic traits. So we have incredible potentials, and our destiny lies in reconnecting with the stars, and that'll be an incredible experience as all that information and that history kind of comes into the consciousness of all of us.
Awesome. Well, I know you have many speakers at the conference next weekend. We just had four of them on besides yourself tonight, and my regret is that we didn't have enough time to hear from all of them. But how can people that listen to this broadcast access the wealth of knowledge that will be imparted at that conference?
Well, I mean, firstly, they can go to the conference website, which is etworldpeace.com, and they can see a little bit about each of the speakers in terms of their topics. We do plan to have all of the sessions taped, so there'll be DVD copies available.
Excellent. And they'll be available on that website?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So once the conference is over, then people can visit the website and put in their orders for the speakers, and they can actually have the whole conference basically played out. We do plan to also release a conference declaration. We plan for this to be more than just a kind of talk fest, but to be a more interactive experience for the speakers, the audience, and so that we actually produce a document that can go out to the world to actually outline, well, how do we establish peaceful relations with extraterrestrials? So this is something that
that I'm working with the speakers at the moment in putting together, and that'll be circulated at the conference. So that'll also be made available through the conference website. So if people just go to that website, etworldpeace.com, they can learn about what's happening at the conference, and we'll have information periodically put up there. So if people revisit or join the Exopolitics Institute to get information, they'll be updated.
Excellent. And we have the ET World Peace banner on our website, and we'll keep it up there for a while and provide links to your DVDs when they're ready for sale. Do you have another conference? Is this an annual thing, or do you have another one planned in the next few months somewhere?
Well, we are thinking of doing an exopolitics conference in Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona. So this is something that's still in the planning at the moment. But we definitely plan for this to be an annual event. So there'll be an ET Civilizations and World Peace Conference for 2007, and I certainly hope that you'll be a part of that, Brooke, and we'll talk about that more as it unfolds. But I think this is the first of a series, and I mean, this is really important that we start to think about how to create world peace in relationship with the extraterrestrial visitors.
Well, I for one think that it's crucial in the metamorphosis of the race of mankind that peace is achieved, and we rise above at least our recent history of being so darn warlike. Hopefully, the not only off-worlders, but individuals that have had off-world interactions, and those that have some genetic proclivity, these futants that have the ability to, without violence, see solutions to the problems that we have on our planet. Hopefully, all of that will precipitate the survival of the human race and the potential, I think, to which we have the heredity to do. Hopefully we're able to rise above all of that. And maybe, maybe we'll be ready for a global first contact pretty soon. Hopefully we won't be blown away by it. I think we're being prepared in a lot of different media, not just radio and movies, but also just as I said in the first segment, or the second segment with Paola, that there's some kind of, I don't want to call it telepathic, but there's some kind of consciousness that's being poured out over the earth, and those that are, well, for lack of a better term, called in tune, are able to pick that up and realize that when they walk out in the morning and see those glorious green colors and birds flying across the landscape, that this is a very beautiful planet on which to live, and there's really no reason to fight about it.
Well, yes, we need to just learn how to get on with one another, because that's going to play a big role in how we interact with the extraterrestrials who are visiting and monitoring. And one of the things that we aim to do at the conference is to also give people some information about how they can all play a role as citizen diplomats. I mean, we think of diplomacy as something that nations do and statesmen do, but actually diplomacy is something that individuals do and have been doing for a number of decades now. So we want this to be understood to also apply to extraterrestrials, and we'll have one of the world's leading experts in citizen diplomacy there. That's Ambassador John McDonald. So he'll be talking about his role in citizen diplomacy, and I certainly have had a background in that area too. So I'll be talking about my experiences. So there'll be some important information that will help people to better prepare for how to deal with the extraterrestrial presence.
We got about 15 seconds left. I just want to say that I appreciate your appearance, your guest's appearance, and that this is X Squared Radio, and I'm Brooks Agnew saying, peace, Earth Explorers. We'll see you next Sunday. Goodbye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program. And we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.